Well, good evening and welcome to this live stream event on the 29th of June. Oh, I will get the date right one time. 29th of June. And great to have you on board. As normal, we're going to do a few introductory remarks and then bring our guest straight in. So, as always, let me just highlight the fact we're not talking about financial advice here. We're not giving financial advice. It's a general conversation. Do please play nice in the chat room. And no racial slurs. We do moderate the stream. We will chop people off if they get antsy. This is out the 29th of June 21. If you want to get my attention or ask a question, then use @WhatTheWorld. And I've also enabled Super Chat, which allows you to make sure your question gets the top of the list. And indeed, if you want to make a contribution to help us do what we do on the channel here, that would be greatly appreciated. We don't do this for profit. We do this because we're really interested and concerned about the current situation and the financial decisions that people are making. And if we can help make better decisions, then that's a good outcome. So that's how I think about it. Anyhow, without further ado, as it's the last Tuesday of the month, I'm very pleased to have Damien Klassen from Nucleus Wealth on, and I'm going to bring him in now. Damien, are you there?
Martin, how are you?
Yeah, very good. How are you going?
That's not too bad. The shoe's on the other foot for a change. It's Tuesday, me in lockdown, and you're free. Whereas, we've got the opposite for a change.
Yeah, it's spreading, isn't it, unfortunately? And, you know, it's very interesting talking to a couple of people today in the SME sector who were just sort of swimming, you know, keeping their, at water level, as it were. You know, they jettisoned a lot of staff. They'd been dipping into their own personal finances, and they were hoping that the holidays and then, you know, into the next 2 months or 3 months would actually start to turn the corner, and suddenly, bang. I think we're going to find quite a few going to be in some, you know, deep doo-doo ahead, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, it will be interesting to see whether, obviously most of the government support has come to an end in Australia, and so it'd be interesting to see whether there's actually enough states now locked down, and you know, obviously Victoria's only just recently exited, and I think we're sort of, there's a lot of people within Victoria taking the view that, look, we've just got a slight reprieve for a couple of weeks before it's us as well. That maybe some of these make a reappearance, because as you said, it was certainly very, it's one thing for governments to be having lockdowns when there's job keepers and job seekers and all those types of things designed to prevent those issues, as you spoke. So certainly on high alert at the moment for signs of danger.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, New South Wales, they have actually announced now some support for businesses. You have to actually get an accountant to prove your turnover's come down, and then basically you can get a certain amount of money by way of grant, which may help some, but nevertheless, it's tricky times.
Sounds like it will help accountants at least.
I was going to say, I think it always seems to me that accountants win whatever, you know, accountants and lawyers, they're always the ones that seem to do quite well. Look, there's a lot we can talk about and should talk about tonight, but I think a really interesting place to start would be to talk about the tech sector, right? Because there's been a really interesting change in the wind quite recently. When the inflation story was really booming, a lot of people were saying, well, hang on a moment, the future earnings of all these techs will be discounted, therefore they're not as valuable, so prices started to come back. That's now turned around because inflation is perhaps more transitory than we thought. At least we've always said it was transitory, but others
thought.
Yeah, exactly right. And now we're starting to see the tech sector, particularly in the US, really, really booming. You know, we know that Facebook hit the $1 trillion. What's your thoughts? And you know, what does it tell us about the nature of the economy and specifically the trajectory of tech stocks ahead?
Yeah, certainly. So this is one we spoke about last time as saying, where do you put your money in our last inflation special? If you're going into a period of less inflation coming off, is that growth stocks are one place, and we spoke about quality growth as being one of the key areas we're looking at. And we're treating it as a barbell. So at one end of the barbell, we have our growth stocks, and the other end of the barbell, we have defensives that are the stocks that are more interest rate sensitive. Things like your REITs, and we spoke about American Tower as being one of our big holdings there. and those ones that are that will benefit as interest rate falls. So you've sort of got a higher risk end and a lower risk end to sort of help give you some rewards. And that's been basically the stocks. Both those sectors have done very well. The other sector that is doing really well is obviously the what we sort of call the junk growth or the higher risk growth, where it's stocks like your Teslas and things like that actually aren't earning any money. And so you get some very exciting returns in those ones, but the danger is if you do get market pullbacks, they don't actually have the earnings sort of certainty to fall back on. And that's why within our portfolios, we're heavily overweight the FANGs, Facebook, Google, Microsoft and Apple are sort of all big holdings within our portfolios. And it sort of varies for the reason. So I think there's different parts where different ways you look at them. But one of the key things that we're seeing very much is that the valuations relative to where they've been in the past are actually not that unreasonable in a relative sense. So if you're lining up all the stocks in the market and saying, let's look at the most expensive stocks to the least expensive stocks, it used to be that Amazon was right up the end in terms of its not earning much and had particularly and was particularly expensive, might have been trading on 100 times its earnings, whereas that's now sort of more like 40 times its earnings, and so it's not as expensive. It's still expensive relative to most other stocks, but relative to because the whole market's moved up a lot higher, it means that it actually looks, it's sort of, rather than sitting at the 99th percentile, it's back at the 70th or 75th percentile, which makes it more attractive. And so we sort of think about a couple of big sort of driving themes behind all these stocks. One of them is the advertising side. So Microsoft, but particularly Facebook and Google, and also Amazon to a certain extent, all benefit from this move to online advertising. And to us, that's just one of these 20-year themes that just means that more and more spending comes every year out of spending on TV, print media, radio, outdoor ads, more and more of it ends up every year on online. And it's very hard to find quality places to spend money that aren't Google, Facebook, Microsoft. So that's one theme that's driving a lot of those stocks higher. The other one that most of them are involved in is this idea of cloud computing, and in particular the storage and the processing that goes behind those. And that's just it's a real classic win-win for both customers and for the people operating, because for customers, they can see their costs more than half. A lot of the time, it might be down 75% in terms of the cost you can save in terms of moving to some of these cloud computing. And so, then because Microsoft and AWS, which is Amazon in particular, and Google to a certain extent, because they can manage who's using computers and manage that, there's computers there that they're selling to their the people in US the US is operating, and then time zone changes, and now places in Asia are using it, and then time zone changes again, and now places in Europe are using it, and so they get to sort of the one set of computing resources gets used right around the world, and so it's very efficient for them as well, and they're making like fantastic margins from it. So Amazon and AWS in particular, has really just every quarter that goes past, there's just more and more of their profits coming from that area. And so that's this sort of rising tide that's sort of affecting a number of those companies. And then the last one then is digging into, the operations and the idea that with people behind the coronavirus there is more outsourcing. There's more people working from home. There's more people using different locations and employees in different locations. And so, which benefits most of these guys as well as that. So, sort of got these fundamental things coming behind it. Now, those trends have been there forever, but a lot of those trends have been there for a long time. And it's always about the pricing. So, those trends might still be there, but if all these stocks went up 10 times in price, then I wouldn't be standing here saying to you, they're still good value and they're still worth investing in. But for us, if we can pick up some of these stocks on sort of the, you know, if you're looking at your Facebooks and Googles, they're sort of trading on sort of mid-20s in terms of the earning to price to earnings ratios, which is you know, for a market where the market's sort of at low 20 times, that's pretty reasonable. These stocks are growing very quickly. They're talking about, you know, sales growth of 20% plus, and for next year probably 30% plus, and profits of growing at similar rates. And so if you can find those types of stocks, then you know, growing that quickly, the multiple you pay comes down very, very quickly if you can pick them up with those at those rates.
Mm. And the other thing to add, of course, is that the reason that Facebook jumped, you know, it was a big jump, was because they're basically the court case where they were trying to argue that Facebook has got too much of the market and essentially was, you know, needing to be split up. Basically, the judge said, just because you've got a big share of the market doesn't necessarily mean that you've got a monopoly on things, and you need to come up with a better set of arguments if you're going to argue that line. And that really is continuing the very light regulatory touch that we've seen in the US. And I think that's one of the reasons why we've got this massive boom in so many of these very large players, because, frankly, the US regulatory system seems to quite support them.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a number of regulatory issues these guys are facing on the negative side. Over the longer term, you know, I'd say that any investor should be keeping those in mind. So one of them is are they too concentrated, and then which parts can be reasonably broken up. So I guess as well, how much value does the company genuinely? How much is the government right versus how much are they wrong? Because if the government's got a concern about, say, say it's Facebook and Instagram, and saying no, you shouldn't be allowed to own both those because they're in similar markets and you know, competing, and so you need to split them into two companies. You're saying, well, how much value does Facebook genuinely get from holding those two, and how much as two separate companies would they be worth you know, on their own? And so if the answer is it's absolutely crucial they must have both of them, because if they've got both of them, then there's all these benefits. Then you know, that splitting apart reduces value for everyone. But if the answer is there's actually not a lot, and that you know, both could operate as separate entities and still keep growing their revenues quite quickly, then you know, from a shareholder saying, okay, well, I've got a share worth, you know, $200, and now I've got two shares worth $100, there's not a lot of difference from that perspective. And I guess so from our take is it varies by company. I think Google's probably got more. They're probably doing more of the. They're probably more at risk, I think, if it got broken up. But the flip side is, it's actually a lot more deeply embedded in terms of how they're doing things, and so a harder one to do. And the other question then is that will take political capital. And I think my take would be that Biden doesn't have heaps of political capital at the moment, and the political capital it would take would generally be to from his own party to convince them, because I think the Republicans would be quite keen to be given Facebook and had taken Trump off, and Twitter had taken Trump off. You know, they're quite keen to put more regulation on. So I think you're sort of waiting for a Republican dominated House before you're going to see that. So yeah, we've got 3 years to run, and so before I think you'll see too much there. One of the other ones is the tax side. A lot of these guys do have what I would call at least creative tax accounting, and in terms of how they're transferring profits to low taxation environments. We've seen the G7 start to talk about ways to get a global minimum tax, and so that is a longer term negative for these companies. Having said that, you know, the rates we're talking about at the moment are 15%. Not really enough to sort of trouble the scorekeeper too much. It's sort of more it would be more making sure that things don't get dramatically worse than where they are already. It's not as if you know, Google and Facebook are all of a sudden going to be back to paying 20-25% tax rates in the US. So yeah, so I think it's there's certainly risks with them, and I think the longer term issues, but my take would be, you know, the next 3 or 4 years are relatively clear. And those risks, given the growth rate you're getting from these companies, those risks are certainly manageable within it. And and you know, reassess at a later, to be reassessed continually at a later time when potentially they're more likely to actually come up as a regulatory issue.
Absolutely. And it's worth, I think, reflecting a couple of things also. You know, the international situation might be different. So in Europe, they are being slightly stronger in terms of the regulatory imposition on some of those organizations. Yes. France, for example, has put a digital tax on. Now, if they get some sort of agreement on the minimum corporate tax rate, that might actually then turn some of those off. So there's quite a lot to play for there. But it seems to me that even in that worst case scenario, these large organizations are relatively insulated from quite a lot of those risks. And the other is they're so deeply embedded in the way the internet works and the way that security works and the way that you know, people go about their business and it's how it's connected to the devices. It's almost impossible to unscramble the egg.
It's certainly very difficult. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what I was talking about in terms of the Google one in particular is they've sort of very much embedded the top to bottom advertising part. So, and they made a number of acquisitions in the past that they probably shouldn't have been allowed to, but now that they have and they're embedded, it's difficult, very difficult to unscramble that. And you flip around to someone like an Amazon, and Amazon's, you know, there's, I think there's some quite reasonable issues about Amazon not paying enough tax and creative as well. I think all these companies do have that in common. And so you should be seeing higher tax bills. But you know, it's a sort of interesting question for those is if there are a lot of shops around and Amazon are competing with a lot of shops, the fact that they've become dominant online and there's lots of other online operations, you know, is that penalising success as opposed to having a real reason for it? So yeah. Mm.
And it's interesting if you compare the performance was, let's say, Facebook, I think, which was up 65% over the year plus, right? Mm. And you compare that with the index, it's outperformed the index. It's also outperformed dramatically the broader S&P 500. And this sort of highlights the, you know, technology world versus the sort of the old world, as it were. And there is definitely a difference of behavior and difference of performance amongst those two areas. And yet, only a month ago, people were talking about rotation out of the techs into, you know, the cyclicals, yes, into the financials, right? Now, yeah, what's your sense there in terms of the, you know, the relativity between those two sectors?
Look, we started rotating the opposite direction into the techs and out of the value stocks. We started probably about 2 or 3 months ago, and then sort of, you know, up until this month, we've been continuing that sort of trend of just getting more with the idea that, When people are concerned about value, about inflation in particular, is that you'll see the value stocks, the cyclicals, your banks, resources, they're the types of stocks that'll perform quite well. And so the idea is, if you think there's another leg up to the inflation one, and that we are headed for more inflation scares, then this will reverse and go back to those cyclicals. Our view is that, you know, as we've spoken at length on your program, is that it is transitory, and so this move you've seen into value was always going to reverse. I guess the question will come in sort of 12 to 18 months when we start to see Biden stimulus plans in terms of infrastructure starting to kick in. We start to see some genuine recoveries from coronavirus. So, you know, assuming that by that stage we've got vaccinations around most of the developed world and you're starting to see some genuine uptick in terms of that. That's when you'll probably expect that same thing to rotate back and for value stocks to have a sort of another turn in the sun. But we think that's far enough out that that there's still a good case for quality growth stocks at the moment.
Mm, okay, very interesting. Now, one of the things that sort of is bubbling around is this inflation or not question, right? And yep, we actually did a few shows together talking about this and came down more on the it's tactical inflation rather than strategic inflation, if I can put it like that, right? It's to do with the base effect, it's to do with the, you know, the COVID and what happened there. And it's interesting because
and the inventory super cycle.
Yeah, the inventory super cycle, which I love. It's interesting that the Fed came out with quite an interesting report, and they actually broke down the the CPA into that which was actually insensitive and that which was sensitive to the COVID, right? To the COVID, right? And what they basically pointed out was that if you look at those sensitive areas, so things like doctors and, you know, healthcare costs and those sorts of things and a few others, right? And also things like secondhand cars, because people got a bit of money and they could then run spend it on secondhand cars. But the core inflation, which is in fact isolated more or insensitive to the pandemic and the pandemic response, is pretty static, right?
Yeah.
And so they've sort of argued once again that this really does show that the real level of inflation is quite a lot lower than many people were claiming it was going to be. Now, you know, we'll see. You presumably you still hold that view that, you know, the super cycle and all the other things we've been speaking about really are explaining it. It's not fundamentally going to suddenly replicate the 80s.
No, that's right. And so, a whole bunch of reasons. I mean, we've got probably, I think we ended up going for almost 3 hours. I think once you add the two or three, I think we did three, did we? Different podcasts. So we've got quite a long one for anyone who's interested in the detail. But, you know, the short version is, you know, it's not like the 70s because there's been a lot of changes in economies in terms of much more services, much less manufacturing. There's base effects coming into effect. There's less unionization than what we used to have. It's more about the wages, and there's not wage growth coming through. We've got quite high, well, relatively high unemployment to what it was, say, 18 months ago. So there's still a lot of slack in that area. I spoke quickly about the inventory super cycle, but it's basically a whole confluence of events that are pushing. So more people, people haven't been able to spend money on services, and so they're spending money on goods. And I think I've got a chart there, Martin, that I flicked you on one of those. I don't know if you got that handy, but that there's about that. That's how now reversing that goods versus services.
Okay. Well, let me just mess around with my.
Actually, it's on the slides, number four, if you've got that one.
Number
still.
Four, okay, just hang on a second.
Yeah, and so there's a number of ones, and we spoke about lumber as being a great example where, you know, from $400 a tonne to $1,700 a tonne and then back down under 1,000 now. So it's still considerably higher than what it was beforehand, but yeah.
Is that the one?
Yes, so it's a chart on the right that I was just wanted to point out. So, retail sales were considerably high, running considerably higher than the pre-pandemic. And a lot of that was because you couldn't spend money anywhere else. You couldn't go to restaurants, limited in terms of where you could do hairdressing and travel and everything. But that gap's now starting to come back. And the idea that as the US is opening up, that will, you know, once again resume sort of back much more closely to trend. And so, and what that means is that if you're selling goods, then you're selling a lot more than you used to. There's this inventory problem it's like a coiled spring. So it means that manufacturers have to have these massive orders because they've got to sell, you know, they've got higher orders, plus they've got to fill the inventory up, and then eventually that all passes through, though. It passes through the system and then you're back to more normal. And if at the same time the manufacturer's actually gone and put on extra capacity because he thinks this is going to last forever, and then you crash back to normal levels and they've got all this spare capacity, you can quite often find prices even go out the other way because the manufacturers built capacity they don't need, and how they're going to get rid of that capacity? Well, they're going to start discounting.
And we've seen that with lumber prices, and there are now other examples in other categories too, where, you know, supply is adjusting and the prices are coming down. And, you know, it's interesting. Now, the one exception of that at the moment is the Dewey freight costs. Right,
yeah,
which is still way high.
Yeah, so freight's an interesting one as well, in that a considerable amount of freight, I can't remember the exact percentage, I think it's sort of around 40% ish of air freight used to end up in the bottom of passenger jets. So it was basically going, well, no sense in hiring out a whole jet when there's actually spare space in passenger jets, and so we can just throw all these throw it in jets that are going around. So that was obviously disrupted by COVID, as there's so many fewer flights around the world. And so and I guess from my take is that and we saw how much the extra goods in that chart, you saw that the goods was like miles above its its level. So obviously you need more ships to transport more goods, but if there's more services then restaurants and things like that, you don't need the ships. And so and ships take a long time to build. And so that whole confluence of those together, I can see that being one of the ones that actually takes longer than other things to fill through. And I think you'll very much see that as you look through the different parts of the economy, is that some parts will be, some parts, the inventory cycle will be over in a matter of days or weeks, and then other ones it's going to take a number of months for it to come through. And the shipping is one of those areas where, we expect that to be one of the ones that lasts the longest.
Okay. And so with that, and then we should just sort of finally reflect on the infrastructure spend, right? So they got it was meant to be 1 trillion, but in fact, if you look carefully, it's quite a lot smaller than that. They actually passed, right? Because there was some double counting and earlier stuff. But then he's talking about another bill to do the stuff that he wants to do, which he doesn't want to put through the same process. So...
So this is the bipartisan one. So for me, this was very much that Biden has a very large stimulus package he wants to put through. There was a chance to get bipartisanship on, whatever it was, a third of what he wanted to put through or half of what he wanted to put through. And so he's basically taken the opportunity to get the bipartisanship on those parts and then come back. We fully expect him to come back later on in the year and through the budget resolution pass. A lot of the other ones as well. So that's one thing. But the other big issue with that to keep in mind is there is an air pocket between the government was sending direct checks. So it's very easy once you pass a bill to say, okay, we're going to give everyone a check for $1,000. A couple of days later you can have that out and in people's mailboxes and pretty soon getting spent in the economy. When you say I'm going to spend another $100 billion building a bridge, you don't write a check out for $100 billion the next day and pump that into the economy. It's a process that goes through planning and engineering and all these things like that. The spending actually comes a fair bit later in terms of it. There's a little bit of spending at the start doing all the planning and approval processes, but infrastructure does not hit the ground running. And so there's this part in the and the bill you spoke about was only just passed, and so and the next one's not even in front of them. So there's going to be this air pocket where the stimulus is falling off, the direct stimulus, and the next set of stimulus hasn't come on yet, and that's one more reason why we're worried about over the next 6 months. One of the things we are watching quite carefully is this whole growth idea that. Will the market hit this growth pocket as that happens? And then the Chinese economy is very much slowing down as well. They've used the whole. There's a massive boom in the manufacturing side in China, the industrial side, which is what we've seen from all those goods, having to make all those goods. And so China 6 months ago started building a whole bunch of extra apartments and doing a lot of infrastructure, and then as the demand's picked up, they're now trying to get rid of that infrastructure and stop that building. And that building part is a lot more important than many people think, especially for things like commodities. And so we ran through that in that report as well about inflation, just the whole issue that could, over the next 6 months, we actually see a bit of a growth scare as China slows down and then this inventory super cycle comes to a finish and the US infrastructure hasn't started yet. And that's probably our main main risk case that we're looking at the moment, is saying, will we see that growth scare and something to be nervous about?
Absolutely. And in fact, last week I discussed this information, which is showing that, in fact, if you look at the annual money supply growth, right, and the US Fed deficit, right, what's happened is it's sort of turning, right? So what we're beginning to see is already the overall stimulus is coming off, right? And what that means is that whilst the Fed might be continuing to do its 120 billion every month, right, some of the other stuff that was there and the checks and everything else have gone. It's gone through the system. They've spent it, right? So money supply is is coming down, and the infrastructure stuff will kick in, but later. So, you know, your air pocket analogy is dead right, right? The chances are that we're going to see a reduction rather than an increase unless they do something very different from what they've been doing.
Yeah, and so, and the thing to remember always is that growth is, particularly in things like government spending, you know, it, growth needs to be higher next year if you want to see growth in the economy. It's, you know, one thing to say, oh, yes, they're still spending $120 billion, but if it was $140 billion the month before, then that's a decrease in the amount. So the private sector will pick up to take off a number of that. But, you know, I guess that's the whole part is where I'm talking about the growth scare is not certain, but it's a very reasonable risk case, and it's a considerable risk case that we're playing with such large numbers that they don't get the handoff exactly right, and that the stimulus isn't enough to support the economy, especially if you see variants that mean that there's some more delay to the opening up, and so the economy might not be picking up as much to help offset the withdrawal of the stimulus.
Mm. And the confidence levels were a bit lower than people expected, right? And this one really, whoops, wrong button. Sorry, I pushed the wrong one. Let me push the right one, if I can get rid of that. Let me try and find this one. No, I can't find it. It's in there somewhere. But there's a chart that I saw that showed that the time not to buy a house in the US has shot up dramatically. I mean, they had to rewrite the scale. It was so big. Right? Now, that could be an anomaly, but it also could tell us something about the state of mind of households, right? Because, you know, the stimulus is no longer there. The economy is still bubbling along a bit, but not necessarily as strongly as perhaps people expected. And maybe they're not going to be so willing to spend.
Yeah, look, that's if you can get that right, you'll probably get the market right over the next little while. I mean, I can't tell you with any certainty which way it's going to go, because households are sitting on considerable savings balances still in aggregate. Although, you know, it does matter where that is, like whether it's rich houses or poor households will make a difference, and whether they're willing to spend that money. And so if you've got more lockdowns and variants and things like that with a negative effect on confidence and a bit of a growth pocket, then they might clam up again and just hold on to that money and not spend. But the flip side is if you get enough momentum that they are confident and they go and throw that money back into the economy, then that's going to be more than enough to sort of push you through that air pocket and out the other side to where you have got real stimulus. Mm. And so that's your that's really where you need to be watching. The key places I'd be saying is that one, and the other one is the Chinese growth over the next 6 months. Inflation, assuming we're right on inflation, but assuming we're right on inflation that's coming off, the next question is those two growth centres and what they're doing in terms of that. So I can't tell you exactly, but we know what we're watching for, and that's part of what I'm sure we'll be back talking about those themes over the next 6 months.
Right, and it's just worth pausing here and saying, you know, we're talking about the US and we're talking about China, right? And some people might be sitting on the stream saying, why are you talking about those overseas markets, right? You know, what about Australia and what Australia's up to? We should just pause to reflect the relative size of the relative markets, right? And frankly, there is so much influence that those two big markets have on our market that you can't make decisions locally without understanding that broader context.
Yeah, absolutely. And so if you took, say, the Australian bond market and you looked at the short-term rates are very much driven to what the RBA is talking about and what they're doing. If you look at the long-term rates, it's all about what's happening to global bond markets. If global bond markets move up by 1%, then the Aussie market yield will move up, at a similar amount, plus or minus a little bit. So, in terms of that, that's in terms of bond market. In terms of the equity market, the Australian economy is very much looked upon as if you're an international investor, as a supercharged way to play economic cycles. So if you think the economic cycle's headed up, then you go and buy Australian, because you'll pick up on the currency and you'll pick up on things like resources and other, well, mainly resources that's leveraged to that world growth. And with the view that if resources are going up, then some of those profits will be recycled back into the Australian economy and push up house prices and other things. The flip side is when it turns, there's a double negative on the downside. So when I say it's a supercharged way to play world growth, that's the way an international investor will look at Australia. The benefit for Australian investors is when we're investing the other way out, we actually get a hedge on it. So when world growth's going really well, the Australian dollar's going up, and so that sort of we get pick up on the stocks and give up some on the currency. But the flip side is when the bottom falls out, then and stock markets crash, and we saw that very much during the financial crisis. We saw it during the COVID crisis. Is that the Australian dollar falls quite dramatically, and that cushions your investments overseas. So, you know, your stocks might be down by 20%, but if the Aussie dollar is down 15, then net, you've actually only lost 5 by investing in international equities. So, that's quite often, we quite often use that as a way to effectively help hedge clients' portfolios in terms of saying, yes, if you're taking some international exposure, if you're taking exposure to stocks, but you're taking it in international, then you can see that some of these negative events, you've got a lot more cushion to the portfolio and taking a lot less risk than you might otherwise think you are.
Right. And interestingly, of course, until quite recently, we were getting a lot of inflow investing into Australia, right? It's beginning to turn a bit, I've noticed.
Well, that's the inflation trade. You know, if you're worried about inflation, quite often the recommendation is to buy resources, and Australia's got some of the best quality resources companies in the world, and so that's where the money flows to. I think you will see that reverse as assuming we're right on the inflation and it does keep fading, and it is this handoff to growth and the switch that we spoke about, then you're likely to see the Australian stocks, you know, underperform international stocks. And so, and keep in mind though as well, there are a lot of Australian stocks that are effectively international stocks. So, completely contradicting myself by talking about BHP and Rio and everyone, but putting those aside, they are international stocks very much on their own, but they're not the ones I was talking about. Things like ComputerShare is effectively an international stock that's listed in Australia. Brambles, CSL, Cochlear, all those types of stocks are effectively really international stocks that just happen to be listed in Australia rather than stocks that are really leveraged to the Australian economy. They're far more exposure.
Afterpay is an example as well, right? Because you know it's reached out into many other parts of the world.
Yeah, well, if it gets its growth, then I think seems to be if it's going to grow as strongly as the share price suggests it is, then they're going to have to grow strongly in the US or Europe. And so while that one's almost a case of the current profits are very much skewed towards Australia, but the based on the valuation of the stock, incorporates the expectation that they will also be hit elsewhere. Right.
And that's why when the inflation expectations were stronger and therefore the future flows were discounted more heavily, their price came way back, whereas now it's moved up quite smartly because, of course, the inflation perspective has changed.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so those are ones, I mean, the danger with growth stocks is always, it's already priced. So it's a bit like if you're at the horse races and you're saying, well, here's the horse that I'm pretty sure is going to win. That may not be the horse you bet on, because if it's a favorite and it's priced, you know, at a dollar and one, and you think it's a 70% chance of winning, you're saying, well, I'm not going to get, even if I win 7 times out of 10 and I lose 3 times out of 10, I'm actually going to be behind on the deal. And so, it's a matter about saying for growth stocks is always going to come back to the price. And that's the part for that, it's not a stock we buy in our portfolio because it doesn't sort of fit our characteristics of having earnings and cash flows and everything like that. We can look at it on a more relative basis. But I guess what I'd say about those stocks is they're already priced for success. You're going to need you know, super success to make a profit out of them. And some of them will do it, but yeah, if you take a whole group, there's always a bit. It's a bit like the, I don't want to call them quite lottery tickets because they're not. It's not that bad, but you know, if you turn around and said, you know, I've got a turn around and look backwards, you can always find ones where you went, yes, if you had bought this stock at a dollar, you know, 10 years ago, now you'd be a millionaire or whatever it is. But for that, that sort of is the counterfactual saying, well, if you bought all the stocks that had that characteristic, there's a whole bunch of them that are now broke. And there's a, you know, there's a bunch of them that have halved in price. And so
hindsight,
yes,
you've made it, hindsight.
Exactly. Eh? It's about finding the ones. Whereas I think you find that with the bigger stocks with earnings and it's a lot more, and you can pick up at a reasonable valuation. You find that on average, you know, most of those stocks will be winners over that time frame, versus taking the more speculative end, where you're basically saying, "I'll hope that I'll buy 10 stocks and I'll hope that I get two big winners out of it rather than one big winner, because you know otherwise we'd be in front of a line."
Yeah, interesting. And taking the conversation a bit further forward, you know, iron ore is a critical element of the Australian economy, right? It's one of our big success stories so far. This post suggested that China's perhaps ponying up with Brazil to try and actually help them with their infrastructure to be able to get more of the iron ore from there. I noticed that some of the recent Treasury forecasts for the future price of iron ore was significantly lower than where it is. It's above, what, $200 at the moment. And going back to your super cycle question, right? And I think, every time I think about it, I think about it in the context of iron ore. You got to say the chances of the iron ore momentum maintaining its current level over the next year or two is probably quite low.
Yeah. Well, so I want to be very careful as well to say the super cycle I was talking about was an inventory super cycle, which is we're short on goods. And that means there's going to be this real demand for goods, you know, all this extra supply, all this extra demand. It's a very short-term cycle. People talk about commodity super cycle, and I absolutely don't think we're in a commodity super cycle. That's, commodity super cycle is what we saw from the rise in China, where, the amount of iron ore doubled and tripled that was needed, you know, by the world economy as China rose and started spending up really, really big on building its cities. In the end, iron ore is a bet on Chinese building. That's where the vast majority of it goes. And China has obviously banned a whole bunch of things from a whole bunch of Australian exports into China because it's trying to teach Australia a lesson. The flip side is, you know, we've never exported more in dollar terms because the price of iron ore keeps going up. So they would love to diversify from there. There's a couple of ways they can do it. One is Brazil, but you know, I think Brazil's pretty keen to increase the amount of iron ore. They've got problems with dams that have been collapsing, and which has really reduced the amount they can put out. I don't think they will be that amenable to saying we want to have China come and build a bunch of dams for us. I think China's probably doesn't have a huge reputation for. I think they've got enough. They'll probably help a little bit, and in preference, they buy the Brazilian iron ore, I think, where they can. There's talk about some African projects, which have been on the boards for years and years and years, and maybe some of those get up, but they're a number of years away. The two bigger risks, I think, for the iron ore price is one, I spoke about the downturn we're starting to see in the building. And so if you look at, you had a chart up there showing about the rollover in the money coming out of the US Fed, there's been a much a similar rollover in the amount of debt in China. And that's, if you look at it's called credit impulse is the main one. And almost every chart you see on the credit impulse rolls over, commodity prices roll over. It's pretty much a one-for-one relationship, sort of, you know, 6 to 12 months afterwards. And we're in that 6 to 12 month range after it all rolled over. So, so I've got a concern on that. The other big one is recycling in China, is that China recycles very, very little iron ore, or very, very little steel, sorry, which is and when you recycle, it's much cheaper to turn it back into iron ore. So it's a good thing to do and environmentally better. The one of the big issues was they were mainly sort of knocking down, say, huts in peasants' huts in farmlands and then building skyscrapers, and skyscrapers is basically where most of the iron ore ends up. As time goes on, they're starting to now to knock down the skyscrapers they built 10 years ago or 15 years ago and put up new ones. And that's starting to generate a lot more scrap, and there's a lot more focus in China about generating more scrap. And you know, that will lift China from sort of, I think it's below 30% now, and somewhere like the US is above 70%. So yeah, you'll see over time that just there are a number of different places where the iron ore demand will fall off. And at the same time, you'll have, you know, Vale's going from 300 million tons to 400 million tons. There's a number of expansions, you know, underway in Australia. It is, to me, it's quite likely you'll see a lot of supply coming on just as the demand is coming off. And the other part of demand, which we really haven't seen yet, but I suspect is there. I haven't really seen a lot of evidence for it as yet, but high rise in developed countries, either high rise apartments or office buildings or retail, I expect to see much less building in that area over the next few years. So at the moment, that's still going on because a lot of it's still, these projects take a long time. And so if you'd already started an apartment building, you weren't going to stop. It does keep going. But there's a demand, not just in Australia, it is globally, to say there's less demand for apartments and more demand for houses as we've had these lockdowns and people, you know, changing their mind about what they want. And then we've seen demand for CBD retail certainly fall away, and demand for office space in most CBDs fall away. And so to me, that means less new ones being built, which you know, is another hit to the steel demand and eventually iron ore on the other end.
Yeah, and of course China also released some of their strategic stockpiles of copper and other commodities to try and actually influence the price.
The price is at it. Yeah, and so and we don't really know how much or how much they have and how much they released, and maybe they didn't really, you know, maybe it was a couple of steel rods, or maybe it was thousands of tons. It's very hard to tell, but obviously they do want the price to be lower. And as well, think about iron ore as a longer term play. Like if you talk about, you know, 150 odd years of it, when you do the real price, you sort of get rid of inflation out of it, look at the real price. It's generally traded around, in today's dollars, sort of $30 to $50 is where it trades. Once back in, when Japan was booming and it was rising up and using a lot more steel, the iron ore price got right up to that sort of $60, $70 in today's terms. And then we've seen the rise of China, and that's where it's really rocketed. Now we're sort of talking, you know, over $200. It's an incredible amount away from where it trades in its long term, over the long term. And there is lots of iron ore out there. I have no doubt that there is more than enough iron ore to service, you know, the world's demands at $200 a ton. It's just miners falling over themselves to produce at that rate. The longer term rate is most likely to be back around $50, where miners are starting to get to the point where they're saying, okay, do we want to produce more or don't we not want to produce more at that point? Anywhere north of $100, most mines are profitable, and there's plenty of iron ore out there. And it's more of just a matter of bringing it on in time.
Well, it's quite a relevant question from Lily, which was that the current situation, right, the next year or two, is it worth looking at, say, US ETFs and energy or oil, but getting out of metals in Australia, which is sort of...
Okay, I'll tell you what I'm doing. Let's put it that way. So I'm out of metals in Australia. We were overweight iron ore at the start of the year. So we don't usually trade this much, actually, but we were overweight iron ore at the start of the month. And we've sold almost all our positions in that now. In terms of energy, is a trickier one. Energy is a very manipulated market. So we have Saudi Arabia and the OPEC holding off millions of barrels per day off the market that, you know, they could bring back on and swamp the price if they wanted to. On the other hand, oil is very different to normal metals in the way that it's produced, in that once you build a mine like an iron ore mine, the production's pretty consistent over from year to year. Whatever you produced last year is pretty close to what you're going to produce this year. And whereas an oil well, it falls every year as the pressure gets lessened. And so you have to keep renewing these oil wells over time. Otherwise, so oil production naturally falls away. And then so you've got this one holding it off. You've got a reluctance on companies to go out and spend on big projects because carbon taxes, because they can see electric vehicles are getting closer to price being worthwhile from a price perspective. And then US shale oil is actually very quick to bring on board, but it's got really dramatic, it falls off really quickly. And so, so many things going on in that market. My broad sense is, at $80 plus for the oil price, I'm either selling or already sold out. And at $40 at the moment, I'm buying in. And then, I guess graduated across that as to where the holdings are. And those levels, I believe over the next sort of 5 to 10 years, I'll just be gradually shifting them down as we start to see the economics of electric vehicles become more appropriate.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is an interesting perspective when you think about the number of countries talking quite seriously about electric vehicles, battery technologies, moving towards net zero and all those sorts of things. So you've got to ask the question about the long-term trajectory of oil, right?
Yeah, and so my take on, I try and bring it back to numbers that people can relate to. And so there's a lot of things about the cost to drive and everything like that, but the way I really think about cars is, electric vehicles is, it's an upfront cost. So you've got to pay a lot more upfront, and you then get a much lower cost going on, both in terms of servicing and also lower costs in terms of the fuel. So the issue is, the more kilometres you drive, the more you can amortise that cost over. So if you're driving 100,000 kilometres a year, it is absolutely worthwhile having an electric car from a cost perspective. You start running into charging issues depending upon how you're driving it, and 100,000 kilometres a year is a lot. That, 5 years ago, it was more like 120,000 a year. I think the crossover on my numbers is somewhere around the 70 to 80,000 at the moment, but that's coming down every year. And most people drive, 10 to 20,000 kilometres a year. So we are seeing those costs come down, and they are coming down quite quickly. And so for commercial fleets, you're probably there already in terms of it being more economical. And I think once you hit the stage where it is economical, that's where, and you can do that through subsidies, like places like Norway are doing that through subsidising the cars to help get them, to help bring that away. But it's not until you really see those numbers start to match that you'll see, until you see a dramatic pickup. And solar power, I always treat solar power the same way. Solar power's got that same cost coming down. You're spending a big upfront to save costs, ongoing costs. And 10 years ago, you needed to be using quite a lot of electricity at the right times to make it worthwhile. And that's just been coming down and down and down. And now in many places around, many sunny places around the world, solar's either the cheapest or one of the cheapest ways to get power during the day. And so, I see that a very similar type of pickup.
Interesting. Thank you for that. Now, here's an interesting one from Ray, which said, will the Fed QE make resource prices change dramatically when they, the Fed, have to change direction and begin to cut back on QE? I guess there's two parts to the question. Do we think the Fed is going to cut back on QE? Yes, no.
Yes.
And if yes, then what are the consequences thereof?
And so it's into a little bit, it's a little bit on why they, if the Fed's cutting back on QE because inflation's running hot, then it may well be that inflation's running hot because commodity prices are also running hot. And so therefore, it's almost you've almost answered your first question by saying, well, no, commodity prices are already running away, which is why they're cutting it. I guess my take would be that I'm expecting inflation to fade, and that there is, in commodity prices, they've been affected by this inventory super cycle and a number of production issues in key commodities, and that once that passes, You won't have the demand. Demand will be falling for all those industrial goods we spoke about, because as everyone starts spending more on services, and less demand for Chinese housing, which is absolutely the most important thing you need to think about, because that just uses more than anything else. So that's my expectation. So the Fed, so I'm expecting the Fed to be weakening and commodity prices going off. If you take the opposite effect, is the Fed going out and tapering and inflation going higher, then you could probably could come up with a resources rising story.
Hmm. But it's a consequence of some of those other broader decisions, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Now, here's a really interesting one from Donna, right? And it's an discuss, which is, then how do you work out what are Australian shares? Very interesting question.
Oh, absolutely. I will come back to the answer of that, but you know, I spend a lot of time with my international stocks going, well, what are they? So McDonald's, for example, well, what is it, a US? It's listed in the US, but its operations are global. And so, within the companies I follow, what I try and do is break down sales and profits to roughly where they're coming from, but then also to get this idea of where you have mismatches. So, the types of companies I look for is saying, okay, are you producing in? If you're a McDonald's, you're a multinational, and yes, you're working in a whole bunch of different countries. But generally, your costs and your revenues in those countries are the same. So you're buying your staff in Australia, and you're buying most of your products, your breads and your meats, and and your rent and all that is all Australian. And so your sales in Australia, your costs are in Australia, and it'll translate back to the US. And if currency moves up and down, it's just the profits that are being affected. Then you get a stock which is like a resource stock, which you quite often have a currency mismatch, or you have a company that produces all of its products in one country and then sells to other countries. Because what your problem there is, your currency can move, if currency moves up or down, your sales moves up or down, but your costs stay the same. And so you get squeezed by, your sales, the price you're getting for it drops away. And so, so if you're in a currency mismatch stock, and then you have currency competition or not? So you might produce in Australia and sell in Australia, but if you're selling cars or you're selling something that's imported, power tools or whatever it is, that is easily imported, then when the Australian dollar moves, your competitors who are importing from overseas either get a penalty or a free kick. And so you're still affected by it. So I break them down into those, and then I go and then say, okay, well now, what are you exposed to in terms of currencies? If the Aussie dollar goes up, is that a good thing or a bad thing? If the Aussie dollar goes down, is it a good thing or a bad thing? And so, so it's a long-winded way to answer, but it's for me, it's about actually getting quite granular about what you're buying within each of the stocks, and actually understanding where your exposures are. Because and actually that was one area last year we found lots of advantage in, well, the last 2 or 3 years, is we've been looking for US growth, and because the US has been one of those sectors, one of the markets that's been growing much stronger than everywhere else. And if you go to the US and buy stocks in the US, you have to pay up for it because it's quite expensive. But we did find a lot of stocks listed in Europe that were doing the same thing, selling to the same markets, but priced at 20, 30% cheaper than what you'd buy the same stock on the US. And so, currencies are, and actual exposure is a big focus of what I spend a lot of time trying to get to the bottom of.
Right, but the point to make is, just because you're listed on the Australian stock exchange, that doesn't necessarily make you an Australian business, right?
Fastest way would be grab the annual report, find the, most of them will have a geographic section, and then find out what the sales split is. Some of them will give you costs and things like that, which can sometimes be confusing. Start with the sales is a good place, but sometimes there's sort of transfer of profits and things like that that go on, and so it can lead you a little bit astray, but understanding what you're getting is important in these things for whenever you've got a especially if you've got a company with a currency mismatch. say you're producing goods in Australia and selling them overseas, you need to know that that's, you know, the costs are Australian dollars and the income's US dollars, so that you know that's a recipe for quite volatile profits.
Yeah. And most annual reports would have that sort of information because they are really obliged to disclose some of those things, aren't they?
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure even I want to say the Yahoo Finance would have some divisionals, I hope. But there's definitely, I mean, there's paid software out there that, where you can get it, but a lot of sort of news services sites, or like broking sites and things like that, will quite often have divisional earnings, which might have geographic breakdowns as well.
Yeah. Now, Cookie asked a question, which I won't put up on the screen because it's filled up the screen, but he said, in today's crazy market, what PE do you think is considered high, in inverted commas?
Oh, yeah.
Discuss.
What do I think is high, or what does people think is high? Look, I mean, the average, the PEs are close to about 20 times at the moment. Internationally, the Aussie PEs are a little bit lower, is the average. I think, PEs below 15 would be thought of as cheap. PEs above 40 are expensive. And in between that comes back to a bit of the eye of the beholder. If I'm buying stocks on 20 times earnings or above, I really want to see some good earnings growth coming out of it. Like I'm not in it to pick up a 5%, 5 or 6% earnings growth. I want to be able to see, 15% or better, which is why what we were talking about before, some of those, Facebooks and Googles you can pick up for 20 something times and get 20% growth on. Look more attractive. But there's other people out there who'll tell you that, 25 times earnings is only a little bit higher than the market. There's a company that's growing at 8 or 9%, which is a good growth rate, and so it's worth it. I don't want to sound too old, but I feel nervous at that point.
It's a depends question, isn't it? Because also different sectors have traditionally different PEs. I mean, financial services compared with some of the tech stocks, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the cyclicality of stocks. So, we just sold some cement makers earlier on, last month. And I think they were sort of on 12 or 13 times earnings. And for a cement maker, which is a pretty boring, low growth company, that to me, that's getting quite expensive. We bought them when they were sort of 8 or 9 times price to earnings ratios, and so once they're up 20%, then I'm more than happy to be tipping out of those and into something else. But there's growth stocks, or even just moderately, interesting stocks with good margins and more stable profits that I'd love to buy at 12 or 13 times where we sold these stocks. So yeah, very much the horses for courses.
And Cookie Boy asked a subsidiary, which was, do you think rates are going to rise in Australia next year?
No. I think, I'm expecting that the RBA is right. Inflation's transitory, will come out of, as government stimulus is withdrawn, a lot of that will be picked up by private companies, but it's not going to be enough to sort of push us forward. We have brought forward a lot of the, some of the first home buyers and the building grants has brought forward a lot of the building, which is great for the economy for the next little while. But I'm not quite sure what the next leg after that is where that's going to be driven from. So, having said that, if they turn around and there's another, the growth does slow enough that we get another big fiscal spend. Let's say there's an election coming and we decide that, there's
funny that
everyone needs more money, which it's now,
it's build it's more car parks.
It's a job. Yeah, that's right. Oh, well, I'd like them to go beyond announcing more car parks.
Actually
building it. They actually go ahead and build the car parks. That'd be useful. Announcing the car parks is a different one, but maybe it's a job keeper for politicians effectively, where we need a lot more money spent. And that could see rates rise if you get enough money spent. So, I don't want to, I think we're in a very interesting place, but I think the glide path at the moment, absent other impulses, is no. There's not rate rises, but we're government driven. So it's whether it be the bankruptcies, whether it be the amount of money from the central banks, whether it be ASIC allowing or encouraging people to borrow more money rather than sort of more responsible lending standards, whatever the case is, it's driven from a government perspective at the moment. And so from an investment perspective, we just need to keep coming back to that. We can make up all these, make up all these plans and what we want to do. But when you're in a government driven environment, we need to be open to change and following what change is going to be done in terms of spending.
Mm. And of course, the argument might go like this, that the RBA keeps the cash rate where it is, but the costs of money to the banks could go up because the term funding facility basically stops, literally in 2 days, right?
Yes, yeah.
And from then on, the banks will need to either pay more on deposits or tap the international markets, which will mean that they probably will need to think about some way to cover some of those costs. That could translate to higher interest on some mortgages.
Yeah, well, I would think that my expectation is that you'll see fixed rates go up, and you've already seen that at the margin. There's already been a few banks sort of putting them up. So yeah, I'd say that's the case. But the flip side is, if we do get a bit of a growth scare later on this year, and China slows down, and iron ore, then maybe the it's pretty quick and easy to turn that TFF back on again. And so I'm actually surprised they have turned it off, I suppose. Europe never actually turned theirs off. They put it on as a temporary one, and must be 5 years ago now, and it's still going.
It's still going, exactly,
so,
right.
Any sign of weakness, that'll get turned back on again. So right. I guess what I would say from that is, I wouldn't go banking anything, or banking on any, that being off forever.
And I would argue that the fact that they've come out and said they're happy to extend help to people who are actually currently in lockdown, all four of the big major banks have come out with that, I believe that will be a precursor to the TFF being extended.
Right. Yeah. That's a.
We'll see. Could be wrong.
I certainly wouldn't bet against you on that one. I don't know if it'll be extended, but I'm certainly expecting. I'm expecting the way things are going that by the end of the year that we probably will have some more support in terms of that. As if we're right and inflation's rolling over and starting to see, because the other thing is we will see the base effect go the other way as well, where the latest stuff starts to become the base for next year.
It's a continuous process. Now, there was a question asked by Debt and Regret quite a lot earlier, but I didn't bring it in earlier because I wanted to sort of cover the international side first. It's a probably related one, right? But I'm interested in your perspective. He's talking about Southeast Queensland, and the question is, where do we think the property market's going? Now, I always say, and I think you probably would agree with me, you can't talk about the property market, right? There are multiple micro markets in multiple different parts of the country, houses versus apartments, et cetera, et cetera, right? And we know that houses are quite hot, units less so, but we also know that Queensland's been doing significantly well because of all the interstate migration, and we think that's probably going to continue. So I don't know whether you've got any perspectives on the property market, but I'll give mine in a second, but I thought we might just spend a moment or two talking about that before we pick up some of the other questions.
Yeah, well, okay, so there's a whole bunch of layers to this. It's still quite attractive, buying versus renting, relative to where it's been in the history, in terms of Queensland. If you can afford the deposit, then the ratio of rents compared to the payment on a mortgage is quite attractive relative to history. So that's supportive. I sort of had a slight problem in the whole, if you're thinking about it, this is a 6 to 12 month issue. I'm hoping the question is coming from a question of timing, from a point of timing. Should I buy now if you're committed to buying anyway, or should I sell now if you're committed to selling anyway? But because if you're thinking about buying and then selling, 6 to 12 months, I don't think you're going to get a good return on enough of a return to pay for all your stamp duties and all those other things that go into it. So I guess what I'm saying is if you're talking about this as a buy, you want a 5 year or a 10 year view. And so we've got a property calculator on our website, nicholaswealth.com, that sort of gives you that type of feel for and compares the cost of renting and buying. So yeah, very much recommend popping along there. But if it's a question about saying, look, I'm committed to buying anyway, or I'm committed to selling anyway, I think there's a decent chance that the current demand starts to tail off, but whether that's enough for prices to fall, I suspect not. I suspect you're still going to see at least mild price rises, unless you saw either a dramatic downturn in the economy, in which case there'll probably be interest rate support, and that in terms of that growth hole I was talking about. So I'd say property prices are probably all right, absent catastrophe over the next 6 to 12 months, and that the Southeast Queensland, the rent versus buy adds up.
The rental returns up in that part of Queensland are much, much higher than anywhere in New South Wales, anywhere in Victoria, right? Mm. By a factor of, in some cases, two. So there is a very strong investment calculus in that part of Queensland, right? Yep. More so for houses than apartments, actually, but it's still pretty strong. Mm. And then the other thing, of course, to bear in mind is that these property price moves that we've seen in Australia have been replicated in pretty much all Western economies. The data came out today from the UK. The average house price in the UK has gone up, I think, by 13% in the last year, right? And some averages higher. Interestingly, London less so. So some of the other areas outside of London actually performed way better than London did, which is interesting.
And it's the same as what you're seeing here. People are like, if it's a choice being locked down in London in a small apartment, or I can go and now I can work from home more often, I can go and live 2 hours away.
It's the same, exactly the same phenomenon, right? And that's why Southeast Queensland is an interesting example of that. We're seeing other regional parts. A lot of people have moved out of Sydney down into the Illawarra, where I am, and therefore prices in Illawarra have gone up, in some cases, 25%.
Well, and there was a survey that in the US, I haven't seen something similar in Australia, but if you see one or hear of one, I'd be interested to find out about it, Martin, where they were looking at the number of people that were moving. I think there's a couple of states. I think it was somewhere, let's say it was something like Austin in Texas, and they were looking at how many people had moved, what was the usual number of people moving to that state from interstate and buying houses, and it might have been whatever, 10-20%, and then now it had moved to like 80%, and so the issue was, and that was forcing all the prices up because people were coming in from, say, San Francisco with much larger, they sold their houses and they've got these much larger balances, or they had higher salaries from working in Silicon Valley, and they were coming across and they could get to work there and keep their higher salaries. And you're like, okay, that's, you can see why that's pushing prices higher and helping out, but then you say, well, is that a permanent feature of the market? So if you think that prices have shot up because there's been this influx of people moving from interstate, and that's going to keep on going for the next 5-10 years, then that will help support those prices to keep pushing them higher. But if it's a short term, there for a year or two and then returns back to normal, there's obviously much less support for prices. And then and also if there's an expansion of house building and there's certainly an element of scarcity at the moment, which is changing up those. So once that removes a bit.
Yeah, it's interesting because in some cases listings are moving up a little bit, but the intention to sell for the apartment sector is very, very strong at the moment in a number of other areas. So it'll be interesting to see. And again, I think, I keep coming back. You've got to go to micro markets to understand the property sector. You can't just take these high-level indices for Sydney or Melbourne or anything because they're relatively meaningless. Now, there's an interesting question from Vincent again a bit earlier on about the total amount of leverage in the whole system, right? We've never had more leverage than we've got, right? If you way you look at it, right, there's the amount of debt in the system is huge, and some of that's highly leveraged as well. And there was a statistic that I saw the other day that it would take longer than ever for all the debt that currently exists in the US corporate sector to be repaid from cash flow out of the corporate sector. It's never been that high. Right. And so it's a conundrum about the amount of debt in the system. Now, rates are really, really low, and I think we both probably would hold the view that rates aren't going to go massively high in the short term. So the debt is probably sort of serviceable for a bit. But the question is, is there a limit, or do you think we can just go on leveraging forever?
yeah, I think there's a limit. I mean, it makes the issue a lot more fragile. And the more you get, the more debt you are, the more, you know, when you do have that, when you start letting companies go broke again, then you know, it starts creating bigger issues by having more debt.
So you mean markets, letting market forces actually work?
Yeah, well, that's novel. That's the question in its own right, isn't it? Will they ever be allowed to again? You know, but I guess what I'd sort of go through and say, well, where can we get more debt? So Australian households are pretty full. Maybe you can get a bit more in, but you're starting to get to the your wafer thin mint stage of the meal. Corporate household debt around a lot of the rest of the world has still got scope to grow. So Europe isn't particularly high, but you know, mind you, they've been trying to shove super cheap mortgages down Europeans' throats for years now. And same in Japan, and they haven't sort of been managed to get it to go higher. But there is some scope there. US household debt isn't particularly high, so that's your areas where you can grow. Corporate debt is very high, less so in Australia, but certainly internationally is very high. So that you're limited as to how much extra corporate debt you can get. Government debt, I think you can keep going for government debt. For a lot of developed countries, ones that can print in their own currency. Margin debt is relatively high, but not at the extremes. So this is stocks bought on margin. That hasn't actually been a huge feature of this stock run-up. And the other place I think of it as leverage is uses of derivatives is another. It's not explicitly debt, but it's very much a leverage play, and that's very high at the moment. So, you know, I guess if you're saying about where can we pump more debt to keep the whole thing going, it's governments and households, not in Australia. So is where you can keep pumping the debt to keep the party going for just that little bit longer. One more drink.
Exactly. And interesting question from Ray, which sort of follows up on that. Anyone looks at debt to earnings ratios changing to see if a company is a zombie company? Zombie companies, right? Which is that's the thing that nobody wants to talk about, right? We've got lots of companies in Australia and around the world who are still there, right? Sucking up capital, sucking up debt, not really actually being very effective as companies. But they're supported by central banks' policy.
Yeah, well, and you know, explicitly, not even policy. Like, you know, the U.S. government was out saying, U.S. central bank was out saying, we will buy these debt securities and to bring their cost of funding down. So, yeah, there's definitely companies out there that, if they had to pay a normal rate of interest, and even just if you saw current interest rates, which are extraordinarily low, and a normal corporate bond spread on top of that, there's a bunch of companies that would fall over. So you know, it's actually two levels. It's not only the actual level of interest rates, but the extra part that corporates usually have to pay above that is also at very, very low levels. Having said that, though, you can see I've seen reports that talk about these masses of zombie companies. But a lot of it's talking about last year's earnings. And we know last year was a very special, you know, one-off. There's a lot of companies that made a one-off loss that won't be making a loss next year or the year after. And they've sorted out their operations or got rid of the issues. So, I absolutely think there's zombie companies out there. I don't think they are good for future economic growth. I think that, history shows that countries that try and protect the zombie companies and keep them alive, grow much, much more slowly because of that than if they let the companies, in an orderly fashion, if they let the companies go out of business, the employees go to a different company where it's not a zombie company and grows more, and you have that whole creative destruction, which is theoretically what capitalism is about. It's about allocating resources efficiently. But it's not the world we live in at the moment.
It's rather suspended. There was a really, really good report that the ECB came out with about a year, 18 months ago, highlighting the consequences of all the zombie companies. right? Mm. And they basically said three things. One is it means
is
that...
this is pre-pandemic?
This is pre-pandemic.
And then they burnt it for warmth during the pandemic.
Yeah, no. Right. Well, that's probably right, right? But, yeah. but they said, look, you've got to understand, these zombie companies are sucking up capital that could be much better deployed and getting better returns elsewhere, right, first.
Yep.
Secondly, the consequences of those zombie companies contaminate the balance sheets of the banks who've lent it to them. So the banks themselves don't ask too many hard questions about the zombie companies because they don't want to know, right?
Yep.
Because if they knew, they'd have to actually start making provisions, right? Yeah. And the third is that in the light of those first two, the quantum of debt can lift, but you don't get any significant uplift in overall returns. So,
yeah.
And I mean, for me, those are the critical insights that underpin all of this.
Yeah, and that it's a similar point to the a lot of the debt we've seen companies brought on over the last year, where it wasn't debt to go out and build a new factory or, you know, some new R&D or whatever it is, acquire something that gives you the next leg of growth. It was debt to just keep the company alive where it's at today and get through that negative earnings. And so you're basically looking at the same, yeah, it's the same company you were looking at 2 years ago, but it's just got a lot more debt, and they're the ones where the danger comes. And there's some, it's almost worth an entire episode on its own, but you know, there's some very interesting things going on in China in terms of debt markets as well, particularly the developers. So there's Evergrande, which is sort of the biggest one over there, has just got an incredible amount of debt, and there's probably will need a. I mean, my guess is they'll, whether it's an explicit or implicit, there'll be some sort of government, you know, factored bailout. But I guess the point is there's a lot of issues going on in the development sector, which if they were allowed to play out without intervention, would, in my view, end up in a debt crisis. I don't think they will be allowed to be played out, but coming back to our that keep on that theme when we're worried about governments and central banks propping up the world to keep the thing going, we need to be observant of these when we're saying, okay, well, will they let these dominoes fall, or are they going to get in and start saving some debt investors who should have never made the loans in the first place, but might end up being bailed out?
And the markets are basically assuming that the central banks will save them. That's the fundamental assumption, it seems to me.
Yeah, and it's a good assumption though. It's been true for basically ever since the financial crisis was the decision during the financial crisis was no, we're going to bail out. We let the first one fall over and that caused all these problems, and so therefore we shouldn't let any of these ones fall over, and nobody should go to jail. And so we've created the environment for being able to leverage up without retribution, as long as everyone else is leveraging up. And so that was extended this time around. It's hard to see anyone standing up and saying no, that's enough. We're actually going to let companies go through the natural form of credit destruction. Yeah.
Absolutely. Now, Jason asked this question, which is interesting. Pharmaceuticals, given the current status quo, what's your thoughts? Now, of course, many of the pharmaceuticals are saying, well, we're going to have to, go through, 6-monthly boosters and sorts of things. And many of them, I think, will be thinking, oh, there's quite a lot of money making going on.
Yeah, I actually spent 3 or 4 hours this afternoon going through this exactly these questions with a number of pharmaceutical stocks. But it's very fresh in my mind. The big factors for pharmaceuticals taking a big step back and looking at the broader long-term picture is that pharmaceutical costs in the US are dramatically higher than what you see elsewhere. Most of the big pharmaceutical, that's where they get the lion's share of their profits comes from the US market. And so when Hillary Clinton was running, there was a lot of talk about the regulation that would need to be put into the healthcare sector. Biden spoke a little bit about it. My expectation is that that they won't do anything this time around, that they've got enough other things on their plate to worry about picking fights with pharmaceutical companies. And that there's probably a bit of kudos in the US and a bit of support for pharmaceuticals in that they have saved the day in the US in terms of the vaccines have come out and they've been quite, you know, extremely quickly developed and all that stuff. And so in the US, which was doing a terrible job with management of the coronavirus, has seen a bunch of its own companies, you know, be the leaders in terms of vaccines. So my guess is that you won't see any of that, which is your big danger for pharmaceuticals. And so beyond that, they generally look relatively cheap. You find you get ones like you know, Bristol Myers Squibb and mental blank on some names now, that are trading at that are quite cheap. They're trading all at levels that are around sort of, you can pick them up for 10 times earnings, maybe 12. Some of them have expiries of patents that you always need to be quite careful about what you pick up. And then there's another batch of some of the ones like, say, Novo Nordisk or Eli Lilly, or that are in sort of sexier areas, and they'll sort of be in the low PEs of like low 20s. And so it's that trade-off between value and quality that you've got to make within those. And so within what we're buying, we buy quite a lot of pharmaceuticals in terms of number, because our view is very much that, you know, the pharmaceutical companies themselves don't really know which drugs are going to work and which ones are going to be successes and failures. And so they tend to take lots and lots of bets. And we're a little bit the same in terms of saying, well, there's some areas we particularly like, say things like obesity drugs or diabetes, where we think there's a structural growth in those over time. But as a universe, we're trying to trade off that, buying the good quality pharmaceuticals or the cheap ones, and a mixture of both of them, and trying to spread our bets between them. So yeah, we're not hugely overweight, but we've certainly got a decent sized holding in it. And I'd recommend within the portfolio that pharmaceuticals do make up a part of that. And one more disclaimer. The Aussie pharmaceuticals are very expensive. Yes. So, you know, CSL's, you know, 40 times, which is like basically as more expensive than most other pharmaceuticals out there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Very interesting. Okay. Well, we're coming up towards the end of the show. I've got two last questions. The first was reverse repos. We just need to touch on this briefly, right? Because it's the thing that nobody wants to talk about, right? Just to be clear. Right. US banks are basically putting a lot of that money that was given by the Fed to the banks back with the Fed because they can't find anybody to lend it to. Discuss.
Right. So now we're talking about plumbing of the financial system, really. So I guess there's two ways you can look at this. There's plenty of places on the internet you can find stories which is basically saying, here's something which doesn't really make a lot of sense, and here's this plumbing is going to get all clogged up and it's going to be the end, you know, and that's what's going to cause the next crash. I think there's enough weird things going on within markets that we do need to be very cognizant of some of the plumbing issues. My expectation is that you will see the Fed step in to clear up those plumbing issues as they occur. But back to the theme, I don't want to rab it on too much, but I will, so because it's said it is the theme, is we're governed by central banks and governments, and so watching those plumbing issues for issues that can blow up is important. I think that Biden stimulus is probably more important than what the US Fed's doing. I think the Fed is sort of reached its close to its limit of being able to help things. It can still harm things by doing the wrong thing, but it's pretty close to the limit of how much it can help. Now it's very much about the Biden that's sort of going to question about whether he can keep doing the good stuff. So plumbing issues are something to watch, but it's not something that keeps me up at night thinking this is definitely going to be the next crisis.
Well, I'm rather with you, Damien, because there's a lot of stuff elsewhere in social media that's sort of saying, see, this is the big issue. You know, I'm not sure that it's an issue, I should say, but yeah, it's part of a bigger tapestry of issues where they're all sort of interrelated. And I agree with you, it's the stimulus stuff, particularly from Biden, is probably a quantum bigger.
And it's that point that things are changing so much that the plumbing's changing, and we don't, there issues will definitely come up and they will need to be resolved. So you're relying on central banks to do it.
But the point is that central banks over the last decade have shown that they're willing and able to do whatever it takes to keep the squeaky old machine running the way they want it, right?
That's right, exactly.
Whatever it costs, however you do it, you keep it running.
Absolutely.
Okay, last question for tonight, and this is from George. What's your view of the next 12 months, and particularly the Dow Jones and the S&P 500? Higher, lower? No idea. What do you scenarios? I don't know how to think about it.
It's scenarios, really. So look, there's some base cases and some upsides and downsides. The base case is that earnings growth is still very good. I expect inflation will come off. I expect that wage growth will be pretty muted, and corporate profitability is going to be very good over this time period. Governments are going to keep trying to pump more money into the economies. And that generally means that corporate profitability, ends up going well. It'll be an interesting question about which sectors are the bigger beneficiaries. I'm sort of less worried. So I think, was it the S&P and the Dow Jones there? So I'm more on the S&P, which is like a broader index. The Dow Jones tends to be a bit more, it's a weird structure of the index, but tends to be a bit more the manufacturing and the old school ones. So I would treat that as I'm not as positive on the manufacturing side, because I do think you'll get a switch back to more services. There's some pretty big risk case, and the big risk case is that growth bubble that I spoke about. The growth hole that we're talking about. So US, the handoff between spending on corporates and getting infrastructure going, there's a hole there. And China rolling over in particular. So they're your big ones you really need to be watching. If the market's going to turn down, that's where it'll be. And we've sort of spoken about it being, in the sort of about a third, maybe as high as 40% probability that does morph in. So it's not a tail risk. It's a very real risk that investors need to be worried about, but it's not a base case at the moment. So that's where I'm treating as happy to be. We're slightly underweight equities, just a little bit of conservatism on that front, but very closely watching that growth to try to work out if that's going to turn down, because that'll really very much drive that drive performance, and that'll tell you whether the market's going to be higher or lower.
And the point of all of this is the level of uncertainty that I certainly see is as high as I think I've ever known. Right, there are so many variables, and there are so many ifs and buts, and there are so many assumptions, right? I don't think anybody can be absolutely definitive about where we're going to be in 12 months' time. It's just you got to try.
As well, that's the other thing which makes the much higher risk.
Yeah.
So if markets were, rather than being 20 times, if they were 10 times, I'd say to you, the markets will probably be higher. And you know what? If they're not higher, who cares? It'll be down a little bit, and there's plenty of upside, and you're getting lots of corporate growth and all that type of stuff. But at 20 times earnings, your margin for error is much lower. And it's a bit, coming back to that horse racing analogy, it's a bit saying, well, if I can pick up the favorite, get 10 to 1 odds, then I'm happy to do it. But, when the odds get back to 3 to 1 or 2 to 1, now it's a much more important decision about how likely is that to occur. Still the favorite, still the most likely to win the race, but you're going to make a lot less money from investing with that.
Mm. And intuitively, with markets so high, the chances of it going a lot higher is probably lower than it coming back. But I don't know what that probability is, right?
Yeah. You do have some downside skew, but on the other side, you've got some people with printing presses who are on your side when you're buying the market.
Yes, that's exactly right. Well, we're really coming to the end, but Cookie Boy just sent me a chart, which I'm not going to go through in detail with you because I don't think we can do it today. But he basically listed out some of the top performing growth investment funds, right? Workplace super funds. And he was highlighting the fact that some of them over the last year have done really, really well. Some of them less well, right? And, the fact is that a lot of super funds have had a really good year. The interesting observation is that those people who sold out, you know, March year plus ago, are probably regretting it now because the markets came roaring back, right? And I think the observation here is you've got to look through the cycle a bit, right? When you actually make thinking strategy and also thinking about returns.
I think there's a number of studies out on retail investors talking about retail investors versus versus professional investors about the returns they get, and they tend to have roughly about 2% underperformance over on average, and the reason is usually because of timing of the market. Is that they see investors see lots and lots of returns, and then they think, okay, now it's time to jump in. And then they see everything, poor returns, they think now it's time to get out. So they tend to get in and out at the wrong times. I've got I need to get a written copy of this one, but there's a fund manager who I'd listened to, and he was talking about saying how he'd outperform the market by 3 or 4% per annum, you know, every year for sort of close to every year over a 10-year period, and was talking about his clients and saying, well, he thought his clients had actually underperformed market, and saying, well, how can you outperform the market but your clients have underperformed? He said, well, every time I have a few good quarters, they all throw money at me, and then when I have a few bad quarters, they all take money out. And the net effect, when he'd gone back and calculated their, you know, their return, was that they'd actually underperformed while he'd outperformed. And so it's similar with that. What the market is, there's a certain amount where it's a strategic view. You know, we think there's benefits in terms of leaning into the wind and leaning against it in terms of what you can get, but you need to be careful as an investor that you're not also doubling up. And so, you know, your investment managers decide to be a little bit conservative, and then you've added this extra level conservative on top of that, and that's ended up with the returns that you're missing those.
Absolutely, and I will make another point. A lot of the performance tables that quote the performance of the fund don't necessarily translate to the performance to individuals within the fund, right? Because there's a bunch of other fees, trading and management fees, that aren't in those aggregate numbers.
Yeah, that's right. And I think did we speak about it with you last time? I think we might have. That the way they're reported is, so there's an investment fee and an admin fee, and usually the super funds report their returns minus the investment fee, but they don't include the administration fee. And so, over the last few years, the aggregate fee is, say, the same roughly for most of these super funds, but their investment fee has been shrinking dramatically while the admin fee has been growing. So some would say that's just so they can report better performance rather than actually deliver better performance.
Yeah, well, I reckon we might have a future discussion more specifically about how you judge the performance of funds, right? Because there's a lot of rubbish out there. There were some recent changes that went through Parliament, which changes some of the regulatory reporting stuff. There's a lot of stuff that the regulators have sort of tried to do and haven't really succeeded very far. My bottom line is, if you take the high-level numbers as reported by APRA, for example, or some of those public tables, you probably aren't getting a very good story.
And it's... You know, my preamble for that is it's very interesting. It's very interesting that there's an industry where a Liberal Party has said, okay, we want to get more, we want to get a better returns from this industry, and so we want fewer companies in it. So we're not going to give out new licenses, and we're going to try and convince people in the industry to merge with each other. Ordinarily, competition is leads to lower prices, and you say, well, let's open this up and let more people at it.
Sounds like Coles and Woolies all over again.
Yeah, it's basically can we create some oligopolies in Australia?
We seem to be good at that. Well, good at something finally. Yeah. Look, a very, very interesting and important conversation tonight, Damien. Thank you very much for your time. As always, we didn't get through all the questions, but we got through quite a few. We'll just mention, of course, that there is the Walk the World Fund, which I think I've pushed the wrong button. Done that? Oh, very, very good. Yeah. It's a bit of a slow one, but that'll do. The What the World Fund that is actually run by you guys, and we've had some you know, good people come across and get, I think, some good advice from you guys, and also the ability to be able to manage your own funds and all sorts of things very transparently. So, you know, I do recommend, if people want to think about this, that's quite a good way to go about it.
Yeah, and one thing I'd recommend, you know, even if you're just interested as a observationally, is register your details there. We'll send you out, you know, updates with our thoughts and investment views, and you can jump on and have a look at the portfolios that you'd have a look at the portfolio that you'd get, and there's certainly no obligation within it to, but yeah, certainly welcome you to jump in and have a look and ask questions. We have financial planner. Financial planners that you can talk to if you've got any specific questions, and make them there.
And the point is, the degree of transparency that you guys are running is pretty remarkable in the industry.
Yeah, every stock and investors can see exactly why we own the stocks and why, you know, those things I was talking about. So, you know, let's say, you know, you want to see more detail on Facebook, you can jump in and see the numbers we're using. You can see where it sits on our risk versus return metrics. You can see a written reason out as to why we bought it and where we think the issues are and what we're watching for. So the idea, I mean, it's very much that idea that if you're running your own, I mean, we're assuming that there's other things you do. Maybe you're running your own business. Maybe you do your own investing around the edges, and we're just going to be a part of that. Is we want you to see everything we've got, so you can go, okay, well, if these guys already have a big exposure to those, I won't go and buy more. I'll go and buy something else to diversify my portfolio a bit better, or at least be able to see that when we are going, you know, we've already got a lot of equities, or if we haven't got much equities, you can incorporate that into your own view and how you're doing other investments.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for your time once again. And we might do a deal again this time next month when we'll know what is going on. Well, maybe not.
almost into the next reporting season.
Exactly right. Yes. New financial year. Maybe the lockdowns will be over. Who knows?
So, yeah. And certainly there's, the US, the earnings are pretty key to us at the moment. Is we just keep seeing those earnings growth figures come through. We'll have the first week or two of US reporting season. So we'll be able to talk a lot about, you know, where they're at and whether we are still seeing that earnings growth coming through. Because once that stops, that takes away the justification for markets trading on 20 times earnings.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much once again. Really appreciated all your insights there. And I'll look forward to picking up the conversation down the track, and have a wonderful evening. I'm going to take you offline and I'll close out the show. See you later.
Thanks. See you.
Cheers. Well, there we go. We've gone way over time, but he's always too generous with his time. So thank you very much, Damien. And just to let you know that next week I will be updating the home price scenarios and the stress information. There's some big moving stories to talk about next week, so join me for that. And I will also just mention that Smooth Operator ran his quiz again tonight. Thanks, Smooth. Appreciate that. I saw some people involved in that, so I hope that went well. And I'll look forward to seeing you all next week. And have a good time. Meantime, stay safe. And if you're locked down, be extra careful. And if you're not locked down, I hope you stay that way. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics signing off. We'll see you next time.